March 26th meeting of the House Committee on Elections, Ethics, and Rules to order. And I will open a public hearing and work session on House Concurrent Resolution 7. And House Concurrent Resolution 7 is before us. Mr. Stembridge, please tell us what we're looking at.
HCR 7 memorializes the life of Doreen Margolin, 1947 to 2007, Portland attorney and chair of the Portland Community College Board of Directors.
Great. Thank you very much. And we have some people signed up to testify. I will first call Andrea Henderson and Kristen Watkins. Please come forward. Good morning.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Andrea Henderson, Executive Director of the Oregon Community College Association. And I'm here this morning on behalf of all the community colleges to thank you for this memorial this morning in honor of Doreen Margolin. She was a tremendous leader for community colleges. Passionate, smart, always positive, and absolutely committed to the mission of community college and to community college students. She was my board chair when I was first hired and hired me. Was very, very involved with the Oregon Community College Association, served as our chair. She was also extremely active on the national level and was a member of the board of the Association of Community College Trustees on the national level. Extremely committed to community college issues, and she was awarded by our association with our highest honor last October as the Howard Cherry Award as the most outstanding advocate and trustee on behalf of community colleges last year. We will miss her tremendously. She was a wonderful lady. I wanted to thank you for this morning. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Please go ahead.
Good morning. I'm Kristen Watkins, and I'm the Interim Director of Advancement for Portland Community College. Thank you, Chair Rosenbaum and members of the committee, for the opportunity to come before you today. Unfortunately, one of our board members had planned to be here, and her father passed away over the weekend, so I'm here representing the board of Portland Community College and our administration. We really appreciate the opportunity to express Portland Community College's gratitude for your introduction to this resolution. Doreen Margolin made significant and lasting contributions to Portland Community College and the students who attended our institution. As Andrea said, she worked tirelessly both at the state and national levels on behalf of the community college movement. In 1986, she was appointed to the very first board of the Portland Community College Foundation, and she served on the foundation chair as the chair from 1992 to 1993. She was instrumental in setting the pace for foundation giving and really setting a culture of giving among our board members and community advocates. And she donated annually for at least the last 20 years to our scholarship and library funds. As president of the foundation board, she wrote the very first PCC foundation bylaws, and she provided the foundation with hours of volunteer legal expertise and professional knowledge. She was appointed to the Portland Community College Board in 1999 and ran successfully for that post twice during her appointment. As Andrea said, she was the chair of the OCCA board in 2002. She chaired the College Board in 2002-2003 and also in 2006 until her recent passing. She guided the board with intelligence, insight, and good spirit. She was dedicated to the college. She was a known and welcome presence on all of our campuses. Recently, this spring, in honor of her passing, the family has created a Doreen Margolin Memorial Scholarship at the Portland Community College Foundation that will, in perpetuity, be able to support single mothers who are coming back to school at the community college to get their education and to be able to provide for their families. Again, we all miss Doreen's leadership and her particular brand of advocacy, her great wit, and her intelligence, and we appreciate, again, the opportunity to come before you and the acknowledgement that you're giving her in honoring her service. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Any questions? Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House Concurrent Resolution 7? Okay, thank you very much. Members, we are in a work session. Yes, Representative Berger.
Madam Chair, Doreen Margolin, I considered a friend, and those of us in community college circles understand that we lost a giant when we lost her. She was Portland Community College, the face of it, and nationally, Oregon community colleges were sort of on the map because of her national presence and the way she so graciously articulated the community college mission. I would like to move House Concurrent Resolution 7 to be adopted and sent to the full floor.
Representative Berger moves House Concurrent Resolution 7 be sent to the floor with a due adopt recommendation. Is there discussion? Seeing none, will the clerk please call the roll?
Aye.
Esco?
Aye.
Hunt?
Aye.
Groveland?
Aye.
Thatcher?
Aye.
Berger?
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries. And House Concurrent Resolution 7 will go to the floor with a due adopt recommendation, and I will ask Representative Nolan to carry on the floor. I will close the public hearing and work session on HCR 7. We can do the work session.
Yes.
I'll open a work session on House Bill 2761. Mr. Stembridge, please tell us about this bill.
Madam Chair, House Bill 2761 authorizes a city or a county to use instant runoff voting system for local candidate elections. It requires an instant runoff system to provide electors the opportunity to designate first, second, and third choices, transferring the second and third choices to remaining candidates as each lowest level candidate is eliminated in turn until one candidate has a majority of votes. You have the Dash 1 amendment, which the Portland Metropolitan Service District has requested. It would add a Metropolitan Service District to the public entities eligible to use instant runoff voting. And the Dash 2 was put together based on testimony that we've had previously. It deletes the requirement that county clerks use ballots designed by the Secretary of State. It deletes the requirement that the Secretary of State approve the purchase of only voting machines capable of accommodating instant runoff voting. And it clarifies that ballots cast for all eliminated candidates are to be transferred to remaining candidate preferences. Madam Chair, members, we've provided some additional information to you today. One was a report that was done in the state of Vermont on instant runoff voting. The full report is online. This is an excerpt, the executive summary and the outline. I think the executive summary runs several pages, so give you an idea of what else is in the report. There was also information from the New America Foundation, and then we also presented a copy of the ballot that was used in Burlington, Vermont last year for an instant runoff election. A representative from Metro was going to be on his way today. I don't know if he's in the audience or not to speak to that amendment. He was stuck in traffic on the way, so that's where we are.
Okay. Members, we are in a work session. We heard this previously. The amendment from Metro only simply clarifies that Metro is also able to participate in this change. So, Representative Roblin.
Yeah, I just want to say I am still very concerned about this. I've talked to Representative Buckley and told him that I would be glad to give a courtesy vote. It's necessary to get to the floor. But my concerns go to the fact that I'm a believer that when a vote takes place, you count the votes. And then if you want to have a runoff election, you should have a runoff election with the top people getting it and try it again so everybody gets a chance to vote. I have read the material. I do understand that a number of municipalities and others believe that it does give a clear indication of how to get to 50% or more. But I am still concerned about the fact that it allows certain people's second vote to be counted when others aren't. And if you had a runoff election, it gives everybody a chance to make a new selection. And that just concerns me. So.
Thank you for your comments. Vice Chair Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just in response to Representative Rosen briefly, again, the intent of instrument voting is to determine the will of the majority of voters. A traditional runoff takes two candidates, neither one of whom might, neither one has got the majority vote, obviously, in the first election. It takes that selection down to two candidates, and it could very well be that the majority of voters aren't allowed to express their desires given the reduction down to two candidates in that case. So it's a system that has worked very well in the cities that have tried it, and again, this is an option for cities and counties to use if they so choose.
Mr. Berger.
Madam Chair, I share Representative Roblin's concern that about this process, and in a perfect world, if we had the perfect voting system and all were well, I too would probably say no to this, but the fact of the matter is that I'm kind of persuaded by the fact that our Constitution talks about preference voting, and yet we have no system for doing it, and this at least gives an option for preference voting, and there may be others, and I know we're coming to some other things, but there's always more than one way to do things, and until we try and see, I don't think we'll quite get to an understanding of the pros and cons. I think that in balance, I will support this with a lot of the reservations that were mentioned earlier. Thank you.
Thank you for the comments, members. And I would just say that this is only allowing local governments to try this. It's not mandating it, and so I'm supporting it because I think that is something that they should be entitled to. And, yes, Representative Thatcher, good morning.
Yes, good morning. I echo the comments of Representative Roblin and Representative Berger and your comments this morning. It does concern me, but it does. Then again, it's allowing local jurisdictions to duke it out with the county clerks who really hate it, and I see their reasons for it. I guess I'll leave it at that. I may change my mind by the time I get to the floor. I will say that this is a courtesy vote.
Okay. Thank you for the comments, members. We are in a work session. Vice Chair Buckley.
Madam Chair, I move the -1 and -2 amendments to House Bill 2761.
Okay, Representative Buckley has moved the -1 and -2 amendments to House Bill 2761. Is there discussion on the amendments? Is there objection? Okay, the amendments are adopted. Vice Chair Buckley.
Madam Chair, thank you. I move House Bill 2761 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
And Representative Buckley has moved House Bill 2761 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there further discussion? Seeing none, will the clerk please call the roll?
Representative Berger?
Aye.
Representative
Buckley? Aye.
Representative
Estrell? No. Representative Hunt? Aye. Representative Roland? Aye. Representative Thatcher? Aye. Chair Rosenbaum? Aye. Motion carries. House Bill 2761 goes to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation. Representative Buckley, would you like to carry this?
I'd be honored to. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Buckley will carry it.
Thank you, members, and this will be all my fault in 2 years.
I'll close the work session on House Bill 2761. Okay. Members, we will open a public hearing on House Joint Resolution 14. And Mr. Stembridge.
Chair Rosenbaum and members of the committee, HJR 14, upon approval at the May 2008 primary election, amends the Oregon Constitution to eliminate the double majority requirement for local property tax measures in May and November elections. We have requested an amendment that would change the election date for this from the primary in May of 2008 to the November 2008 general election. We don't have that amendment in hand yet, but it has been ordered at the request of the sponsor.
Thank you, Mr. Stembridge. And members, we have a lot of people who would like to testify on this, and we will first hear from a panel of legislators, including our very own Representative Hunt, as well as Senator Devlin and Senator Morse. Please come forward and join us. Good morning, and welcome to the Elections, Ethics, and Rules Committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Always a pleasure to be here. For the record, Representative Dave Hunt from Clackamas County, and I believe Representative Burley will be joining us at some point soon. So Mr. Stenbridge, I'm sure we'll watch for him in the room. Appreciate, Madam Chair and members of the committee, the opportunity to have this bill heard before you. This is really, I think, a very critical reform as we look at election reforms that are really going to make a difference for local districts across our state. This is very high among that list. I think it's clear after all these years of experience that Oregon's double majority election requirement is broken. And this measure before you provides an opportunity to fix that brokenness. Looking back to 1996, you'll recall that voters passed ballot measure 47, excuse me, which included a hidden provision that really was not the core debate around measure 47, but that created this double majority election requirement. Since then, unfortunately, the double majority requirement has placed a really unfair burden on local governments who have been trying to implement essential local measures. To be fair, back then there was a problem. There were 8 elections allowed every year. There was no vote by mail. So local governments really could, and in some cases did, do sneak elections where they would put something out in an obscure election. People really wouldn't be tuned in to the fact that there was even an election happening, and there was an effort to pass them. Several things have obviously changed since then. One, the addition of vote by mail has completely changed the dynamic. So today, every registered voter is mailed a ballot for every election. It's really impossible to sneak an election past a voter today because they all get a ballot and they all have several weeks to be able to vote on that. In addition, the legislature has acted over time to reduce the number of elections from 8 per year down to 6, down to 5, down to 4 today. And this measure, for all practical purposes, would mean the vast majority of local measures would only take place twice a year, in May and November. Any other elections beyond that would be subject to the double majority requirement. This measure would say majority wins in any May or November, which is kind of a novel idea in a democracy, that the majority of voters should have the opportunity to pass a measure. To quote Kevin Mannix, I don't often have the opportunity to quote Kevin Mannix. He was here testifying in this very seat last week. Kevin Mannix said, quote, "I think we need to revisit the double majority requirement. With vote by mail, there are no more sneak elections, and the double majority isn't needed," unquote. Now, I think some are going to argue reforming the double majority will amount to overturning the will of the voters. I think there are at least 3 reasons why that's an unfair argument. First, as I said, this provision was really a very small part of Measure 47 and barely discussed during that entire campaign. Second, the legislature actually did send out a measure to voters in 1998 that would have fully repealed the double majority election requirement. That measure narrowly failed, 51-49. But it's important to remember that that was a full repeal of the double majority, not the reform just for May and November that is embodied in this resolution before you. And third, the addition of vote by mail and a reduction in the number of elections has dramatically altered the situation. We no longer have the opportunity where local governments can pass out a sneak election. And that's why Senator Devlin, Senator Morris, Representative Burley, and I, along with a variety of bipartisan sponsors that you see on this bill, have come together to allow a simple majority to pass local options and bonds. This moderate middle ground approach really will give back to voters power, and as well as reduce the burden on local governments. If you look at the history since 1996, dozens and dozens of measures, K-12, community college, fire, police, library, parks, veteran services, roads, jails, sanitary districts, etc., have failed. Not because voters said no, but because the double majority killed them. If you look at election after election, and it just occurred, every election that occurs, and you'll hear from several of those today, where an overwhelming number of voters, 55, 60, 65, 70, 80% of voters say yes, and yet the double majority allows non-voters to veto the will of voters. Non-voters should not be able to trump the will of voters. No one should be rewarded for not participating in an election. And so HGR 14 is really our opportunity to reaffirm democracy over apathy. And I would encourage your favorable consideration.
Thank you. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senator Richard Devlin, Senate District 19. Representative Hunt and I, and I believe Senator Morse, have been working on this measure for a number of sessions. It actually, a similar measure passed in the Senate by more than, I believe, a two-thirds majority in the last session. Obviously, it did not go very far in the House. I will try not to repeat Representative Hunt's testimony, but I see here on the dais and people with me that I was the only person here in 97, other than maybe Mr. Stembridge. I don't know if he goes back that long. But in 97, voters passed Measure 47. And I think most of you know Measure 47 and know it pretty well. One of the things that's not commonly understood is the constitutional crisis that we were in when Measure 47 passed. It was so poorly written that we would have probably been in the courts for years just trying to interpret what it meant. Because of that, the House, and particularly the House Revenue Chairman at that time, Representative Tom Bryan from Tigard, spent the entire session, almost about 4.5-5 months of the session, rewriting 47 into Measure 50. And we felt, to get voter approval, that we had to mimic Measure 47 as closely as we could and actually also avail people of the same level of property tax relief that Measure 47 had. But within Measure 47 was an obscure little measure, the double majority. Every one of you understands, and I won't repeat what a double majority is. But we also felt at that time that we should actually make an attempt to repeal it, because most of us thought it was a very repugnant thing to have in a participatory democracy. So we attempted to refer a repeal. That repeal was referred to the voters in the May 1998 ballot, and as Representative Hunt has indicated, it failed by a very narrow majority, 51-49. Many things have changed since then, and Representative Hunt has commented about it, many of those. We used to have 8 elections per year. Now we have 4. There are no surprises in elections. You get a ballot in the mail. Nobody's going to surprise you in the middle of the night that you just heard that there's going to be an election on Tuesday. Turnout has improved dramatically under vote by mail. Also, I think there are a number of other things to keep into consideration in this. That is that the obvious thing that some people will identify is a lot of measures have failed. I actually don't particularly have a problem with measures failing if that's the will of the people, but I do have a problem when measures fail when it's clearly the overwhelming belief of the people that the measure should pass. I think people that will testify here beyond the panel here will talk about a number of measures that have failed. In fact, I think some of you are privy, and if you're not, we can make sure that you get a study of measures that have failed that have overwhelming support but still have failed at the ballot. Personally, I just had one of these fail in my district. In the city of West Lynn, they referred a police levy out to the voters. That particular measure passed by 72%, 72-28. They fell short of the double majority by they had 45% turnout. If the 730 people that were between the 45 and the 50% had all voted no, the measure would have still passed by 65%. Now the city of West Lynn is actually facing the issue of potentially cutting up to 40% of its law enforcement personnel and potentially probably making other reductions in critical city services just so that they don't have to reduce 40% of their law enforcement personnel. Principally why I'm opposed to the double majority is that it gives more weight to those that don't participate than those that do participate. I think most of us, you're on a rules committee. This is fun because usually I'm doing this in front of a revenue committee. A rules committee is an elections committee, and usually people that serve on a rules committee, the whole legislature for that matter, but particularly people on a rules committee, understand elections, understand the importance of individual votes, understand the reasoning behind one person, one vote. One of the things that I think in that understanding, as many of us realize, is the ability to vote hasn't been with many of our citizens for a long time. Women did not have the right broadly to vote in this country until 1920. People of color were systematically denied the right to vote until the Voting Rights Act of 1965. People went off and served in conflicts, Vietnam in particular. who were 18 and still did not have the right to vote. That was not changed till 1971. In closing, what I'd like to say is I believe this is a participatory democracy, a representative democracy, and all of us value the public's right to participate. I always use this quote, and I said I try not to use it again, but I always like it so much I just always use it. In probably one of the most dramatic pieces of language that's ever been produced by a chief executive, a president in this country, President Abraham Lincoln, in his Gettysburg Address, said on November 19, 1863, "We here highly resolve that this nation under God shall have a new birth of freedom, and that the government of the people, by the people, and for the people shall not perish from the earth." His words that stick in almost everyone's minds that studies that, of the people, by the people, and for the people, is clearly an indication that voters or that the public has rights, but they also have responsibilities. I think what we're doing here today is trying to ensure both the rights and the responsibilities of individual voters. And I can tell you quite honestly, if I think Abraham Lincoln had to comment here today, he would tell you that a double majority doesn't belong in any state's constitution.
Thank you, Senator Devlin. I think we'll complete this panel before we entertain questions. Good morning, Senator Morse.
Thank you, Madam Chair, colleagues. Frank Morse, State Senator from District 8, Albany and Corvallis. I appear before you today to encourage your support for HGR 14. I won't repeat the testimony that has previously been given so eloquently by my colleagues in support of this measure. For me, the issue is not just the practical nature of holding an election and its impact on my district. I had a classic example in most recently last year with respect to a measure for our schools that failed by virtue of the double majority, but it passed handily. I mean, it was not an issue of the will of the voters, but it failed. It's not just the practical issue. For me, it's the principal issue of what does participating in a democracy mean? And there are two principal issues. Why should we reward indifference? And that's essentially what this double majority does. The second issue is, and I think Senator Devlin referenced it with Abraham Lincoln, the double majority undermines the very foundation of a democracy. And clearly, democracies do not work without participation. But yet, the double majority rewards non-participation. To be heard in a democracy, we must vote, but not an organ. Thank you. I encourage your support for this measure.
Thank you for your testimony. Questions? Representative Esquivel.
Yes, to the my esteemed colleagues, I want to thank you for this bill. I think it's long overdue, and I see that you have some fairly decent sponsorship as well on this panel. I think 5 out of 7 of us have signed on to this.
Do it now.
But we left Peter out. It's the first election thing that he's been left out on. Very
good job.
Yes, Vice Chair Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As Senator Devlin, you can say that quote as much as you offer. I never tire of hearing it. Thank you very much. One quick comment. When I was working on a campaign in 2002, one of the campaign consultants I was working with, we had a voter registration drive as part of our campaign, and she said, stop, don't register voters. And I asked, why wouldn't we register voters? And she said, it'll kill us in the next double majority election. Mm-hmm. And an idea that we would actively not register voters in order to protect ourselves from the double majority. Representative Hunt, I wonder if you'd comment on the choice of the May and November elections.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Buckley. I think if you look at the core principle, there probably should not be a double majority at all. But recognizing the fact that, again, by a very narrow majority, voters did not approve the full repeal, 51-49, I think the effort is how do we come up with a reform that will still honor the intent of voters while reaffirming this core principle of democracy over apathy. And so that's where we came up with the May and November elections. And I think it's reasonable to expect that local governments, whether it's a school district or a city or a county or whoever, that they focus their measures just twice a year. You know, they used to have 8 chances a year. This would basically give them 2 chances a year to send out every November, and a majority of voters could decide those measures. If they decided there was some emergency and they wanted to send something out in September or in March, they would still be subject to the double majority election requirement. So I think it's trying to find that balance between giving them enough opportunities to actually be able to function effectively while also giving some protections to voters.
Thank you.
Other questions? Yes, Representative Thatcher.
Thank you. I've heard it. I haven't really made up my mind on this one, but I've heard it. The proponents say, of the double majority, say that it's really kind of a 25% rule, where you're getting 25%, at least 25% of the voters to approve a property tax measure. But I can see your, I don't know which one of you raised the issue about 75% of the electorate in a particular, was it Westland? Yes. Was it you? Okay. Senator Devlin. Was it 40% of the voters voted and 75% approved it?
45%.
Okay, well, that would exceed the 25%. And so I'm wondering if there's been any talk of making it so that at least 25% of the voters, I mean, because that was the intent of what's been called the double majority now, to get 25% approval still before property tax measure is passed. I'm just wondering if there's been any discussion or thought about just making sure that if you've got a majority of, even if it's less than 50%, it's still 25% of the voters. And that would seems like it would have kind of prevented some of these measures from failing that did fail in these past elections.
Madam Chair, Representative Thatcher, I don't believe there's been any specific discussion of a measure similar to that that would simply require 25% of those that are registered to be in the affirmative on a measure. Obviously, you might have the circumstance, too, where you had 75% turnout in a November election, or 80% turnout, where a measure was had still more than 25% in favor, but still had a majority opposed that had actually voted.
Right.
There has been discussion of different ways of considering this, and I should probably put this on the record, Madam Chair. There is a corresponding measure in the Senate, SGR 27, Representative Hutton tonight, and I believe maybe Senator Morse is also on that measure, I'm not sure. That measure is currently in the Senate Revenue Committee. It's had hearings. It's actually being revised right as we speak, not in committee, but there are amendments into it to move it also to the November election and to move it to the May and November versus what it currently has, May and November in the even-numbered year and May in the odd-numbered year. The only difference that will remain between that measure and this measure is this measure allows 4 elections every 2 years in which a double majority is not in a requirement, but it would still leave 4 other elections in which it would be. The one in the Senate would limit it after these amendments just to those 4 elections for property tax measures. The off elections, this is, I know it gets too complicated, but like the March and September elections under the SGR, you would not be able to put a property tax measure on the ballot. You would be limited to the May and November elections. For practical purposes, they have no particular impact in terms of if a measure was approved, when you would have the proceeds for a bond measure or a levy. They're the same. But I just wanted to put that on the record because I'm hoping that the House and Senate work together and they decide which one to move, because I hate to see similar measures have to be voted on twice in either floor. One of the things, though, in regards to Representative Thatcher's comments is my particular feeling about this, and I said it goes well beyond measures failing or passing, is that if voters can't turn in a ballot 4 times every 2 years to make their will known to the people, and I had heard an expression sometime once in the will of the voters, and that this gives credit to the people that have no will. But if they can't turn in four ballots every 2 years, then we have problems well beyond the double majority in this representative democracy.
And Madam Chair, Representative Thatcher, I might also add, I think the simpler we can be, the better. I mean, we were all elected by a majority of voters. Didn't matter if that particular election happened to have 90% turnout or 40% turnout. We were elected by a majority of those who have voted. That's true with our county commissioners. It's true with our mayors. It's true with every elected official. It's true with every statewide ballot measure. It's decided with a majority of voters. That core principle, I think, is where we should land. And so coming up with anything that were, you know, 25% plus one had to vote yes, I just think is overly complex. And I also think, you know, we've got a very core principle that works here, is that a majority of voters make decisions. And I just think this measure would restore that principle.
Okay, other questions? Okay, thank you very much, all of you, for your testimony. And we do have a couple of witnesses who traveled some distance to be with us today, and so we will call them next. Aletha Bonebrake and Sarah Charlton, please come forward. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Aletha Bonebrake, and I live in Baker City, Oregon, and I've come with three hats on today. I'm the president of the Oregon Library Association. I'm also the director of the Baker County Library District, which has been a district since 1988. And I'm also here speaking for the Malheur County Library, which attempted a district in the last two elections. I want to thank the committee for having this hearing, for having the measure available for the voters to, or for the House and the Senate to consider. I will limit my remarks to simply what has happened in my realm of expertise. I have provided a list of the pass-fail for Oregon libraries since 1997, and if one were to peruse it, you could see how the fortunes change with the requirement of the double majority. It is powerful and significant, and you can track it through the numbers. My library district has had six measures on the ballot since we became a district. Four of them have been during the time of the double majority. We have passed every one. In May, we had a 59% positive vote, but we lost by 60 ballots not being turned in. It was a 49.7% voter turnout. So we went back in November, and it passed by exactly the same percentage of yes votes. The impact, of course, to a rural library district that has to count pennies, as most districts do, is that we spent on two elections money that could have gone towards services, and we also spent private money on campaigns that could have otherwise been donated to enhance library services. For Malheur County Library, for 10 years, they have been working toward a library district. The champion of that district has been Donald Oakes, a rancher who lives just over the Baker County line and whom we've served with our bookmobile for many years. I have helped them in consulting on their campaign measures, and finally they got the will of the people together by the May election to put a district on the ballot so that they could consolidate county services and not have it broken up among the various cities. That measure in the May election passed with a 54% yes vote. However, only 39% of the voters turned out. They then put it back on the ballot in November, and in November it failed by 132 votes. The Malheur County Library will probably have to close on the 1st of July. Thank you very much for allowing me to testify.
Thank you for your testimony.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Sarah Charlton from the Tillamook County Library. Thank you for letting me come today. Tillamook County Library, we were one of the first in 1999 to come up against a double majority. We came in 64% yes, 36% no, but the voter turnout was 45% that time. We had to come back in May of 1999, and that time we passed again, 70% yes, and voter turnout 51% no. We've been on our levy now for 23 years, and 2 weeks ago we had to come out for our five-year levy to keep the library open. Yes was 55%, no 45%, which is quite good for us, but voter turnout was 49.5%. We lost by 74 votes, and they all came in the next day. We're coming out again in May, and if we don't pass with the double majority, the whole library system will close down. That's the main library in Tillamook, five branches, and the bookmobile. And to make it more personal, what that means to us is 23 people will be out of work, 17 of those people are heads of household, $1 million will be lost to the local economy, but the worst part is the 25,000 people in Tillamook County would not have a library. And we would try to go out again in September, but in the months that we would be closed would be people would not have a library, children would not have a summer reading program that summer, and we will lose a lot of wonderful employees looking for other jobs. Thank you for letting me come testify today.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions? Okay. Thank you both very much.
Good luck.
Next, I think we'll call Sue McRory. And after she's testified, we will have a panel that will consist of Michelle Everly, Alice Richmond, and Scott Winkles. Please come forward.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Sue McRory. I am the chair of the Legislative Advisory Council for the Oregon Education Association. But this morning, more than anything, I'm coming to you as a middle school social studies teacher from Albany, Oregon. And my students are very excited that I'm here. Although, they're on spring break, so.
They may not be spending their time listening.
They'll get the full report on Monday. I'm here in support of House Joint Resolution 14, and the first part of this deals with a social studies lesson that I'm sure most of you know, but I teach 8th grade social studies, and as many of you can remember, you do a lot of American history, but you also do a lot of Constitution and government and how to be an effective citizen. And the most important right my students learn is their right to vote, and they are totally astounded by the fact that last May, 38% of the voters voted. They don't understand that, and they don't understand how a non-voter's voice can be louder than theirs. The basic problem with this double majority is it's not the yes or no, it's the non-voter. And I'm not going to repeat what the senators so ably said earlier, including my senator, Senator Morse. I teach in a middle school that's over 40 years old. It has the original boiler. It has the original 9-inch by 9-inch asbestos tiles on the floor. The original gym bleachers. They're all almost as old as I am. Students that have had their children come through school are amazed to see the same desks. Albany is in Linn County. We have one of the highest unemployment rates in the state of Oregon. Over 43% of my students are on a free lunch program. We have increased numbers of students, decreased numbers of full-time staff and faculty, and as you know, back in 99 and 2000, we lost a lot of money that could help the schools. We put together a bond levy for our citizens to help us. We have over 20 buildings in need of major renovation, including those asbestos tiles, electrical systems, fire alarm systems, other things like that. And last May, we held rallies, we went door to door, we had business community members, we had families, friends, everybody going door to door. And the voters said yes, except Albany is between two counties. The turnout in Benton County was over 51%. In Linn County, it was 46%, meaning a combined total of 47% of the voters, which means we didn't meet the double majority. Even though a majority of those who cared enough to vote said, yes, we want to help our schools. So we decided to try again, and in those 6 months between May and November, we held more rallies, we watched door-to-door, we did the same things over and over again in the middle of that gubernatorial campaign that spent over $10 million getting their attention. This time, the same $55 million bond measure passed because the double majority requirement wasn't there. 54% of our voters had said yes, they would support our schools. In the past 6 months, some of the prices have increased. Some of the bids have had to be changed. And a new school that is to go on the east side of I-5, which will help my school tremendously because we'll be a little smaller student population-wise, and squeaking into the timeline for opening by September 2008, which I'm not totally sure we'll get there. I'm optimistic that we will succeed in overcoming some of those timeline obstacles. I'm also optimistic that my state legislature will help overcome another obstacle, and that's the double majority rule that hurts school districts and fire departments and police departments and libraries all over the state. I urge you to support House Joint Resolution 14, and I thank you for the chance to testify. Any questions?
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions? Okay, thanks very much for being here. Next we'll call Michelle Eberle, Alice Richmond, and Scott Winkles.
Good morning, Madam Chair. For the record, Scott Winkles, representing the League of Oregon Cities, appearing in favor of HJR 14. I will be brief in my comments because I feel that the story told by the people to my right is far more compelling than anything I have to say. But I do want to point out a few items. You're being passed out a comprehensive study of local property tax elections that the League compiled. The time frame is from 1997 to 2005. I think we've made a very compelling case in that document. The double majority is certainly not in the best interest of Oregon voters. And the main point we'd like to bring up is that it gives powers to non-voters. For half the measures that failed due to double majority, non-votes were given greater weight than the actual votes cast in the election. Since 1997, 141 of the 1,117 property tax measures that failed due to double majority requirements. 71 of those measures that failed under double majority would have passed if all the needed votes for a 50% turnout had been cast as no. Additionally, we feel that the impetus that I believe was the cause of the double majority requirement, the sneak election, has long since passed with vote by mail. We have 3 weeks to return a ballot. There's a property tax measure on it. There's in bright letters, it comes to your house that says this will raise your property tax vote in there. With that condition gone, we feel that it's time for double majority to be reformed. With that, I'd like to turn it over to Councillor Eberle.
Good morning.
Good morning, Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to be here today to testify. And for the record, my name is Michelle Eberle. I am a resident of West Lynn, and I come here today as a city councilor of West Lynn and also as the executive director for Clackamas Women's Services, which is the only nonprofit domestic violence agency located in Clackamas County. I want to talk to you today about support of HJR 14, and I have brought with me the Chief of Police from West Lynn, Chief Timmius, and the Chief of Police from Lake Oswego, Dan Duncan. On March 13th, as you heard Senator Devlin say, the City of West Lynn had on the ballot a police levy, and this was a renewal of an expiring five-year police levy that was set to expire on June 30th of this year. That police levy had a modest increase for just a cost of living increase off the original levy, and it failed. That meant is that 12 of our 30 police officers we are at risk of losing. Now, although we had 45% turnout of the vote, which is tremendous for a March election, and we had 72% voter approval for the levy, it failed. And it failed because of the double majority rule.
this is just not a system that works for us. Police services are essential, and with the cap on permit tax rate, we have to go out with levies for essential services that are required to maintain our city. I want to switch hats for a moment and talk a little bit about my role as executive director for the Domestic Violence Agency. The 15th of March, a couple weeks ago, I was down here in Salem for Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault Awareness Day, and I actually sat in on the Governor's Council, Domestic Violence Council, their public hearing. There were three women, three survivors, that I was able to listen to testify. Each one of those survivors spoke of contacting the police department and not getting responses. And the feedback from the police department was that they have too many calls and that domestics just don't come up on the top of their list because their resources are scarce. And although they'd like to do more, they're not able to do more. This is clearly an indicator that we need our police, and we need to strengthen our police, and we need to strengthen the response times of our police. And not having the ability to fund our police departments greatly affects our ability to do this. Each one of the women that had come before the DV Council talked about the horror of their physical injuries, the horror of their children witnessing these injuries, and the fact that if there had been a police officer available, it would not have occurred. So as you can see, the need for us to have levies and to have levies be approved by the people who are voting, not those who are not voting, is critical not only to cities for getting essential services, but to the people in our communities that we serve, the women, the children, all those that are in need of those vital services. And I want to just spend one more time and tell you a little bit about the process we used to get the levy passed in March. We had a very aggressive campaign, and it was a campaign. We had true campaign folks that helped us put it together. We were out there with a phone tree calling voters. As a city councilor, I stood on the corner for 4 days as an unofficial ballot collection site. We had signs up around town. We did mailers. It was an official campaign. And that's just not right, to get a police levy, to get essential services. I mean, we should be able to put something out to the voters, have those that participate in the democratic process be able to cast their vote and approve a service. So I encourage you to support this measure and to do whatever you can do to make sure that it moves forward, and I thank you for the opportunity to come before you today.
Thank you very much, Counselor. Please go ahead.
Okay. First of all, I'm going to ask you to forgive me if I make some mistake in protocol. I am not, everybody that so far spoke about this issue, it was what I would have said, but I'm going to say good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I am Alice Richmond, and I live in West Lynn since 1959. I am a good steward in my city, county, state, and country. I am here, my first time, to bring your attention on a bad, murky state plot afflicting the good of our traditional and conventional Bill of Rights. I will begin with a true history. I married an American in the Navy who fought the war in the Pacific. In 1954, in front of a judge in New York City, I was asked, what does the U.S. flag stand for? My answer was, I still laugh about it, it symbolizes our American country and its heritage to respect it, and its design was beautiful. Although my answer was complimentary, the judge chuckled and sent me to night school. <That's done. laughs> And I had my first child in my arms. Uh-huh. Upon the courses, I learned the flag not only represents the country, but our constitution of our nation and our democratic voting method. Back to the same judge thereafter who gave my citizenship paper and pressed my civic duty to vote from now on, being my solemn responsibility to do so, because our democracy dictates majority of votes passes bills, ballot, measure, period. Hence, all the conceptual form of voting, like this double business, is really short as to our basic principles on laws by our nation in guaranteeing the right of the people. So, on March 13, 2007, Western City residents needed to renew, not a new thing, renew our police lady to retain our regular police officer and a mandatory operation to protect our children, home, and all, a necessity, not just a commodity. However, because of the calendar formula in Oregon, three neighborhood associations, leaders abstained their votes, and took upon themselves to cloud a small group to not vote as well. That bothers me. Thus reflecting in an American way to deny a most democratic factor in process. The measure fell short to pass, regardless of the 72 vote you all have in this packet, I thought it was necessary, in favor, and 28% opposed. Okay. How sad that this vote legacy that our suffrage for people established is being misused and abused while our soldiers and are fighting and dying to accomplish elsewhere, which is being derailed right here at home. I ask this committee in our state house to please annul or invalidate whatever such an American statute has double majority when the word majority sustains that what it describes. Quote from Webster, the voting system in which the majority vote that consists of at least one vote over half of the total applies to the whole, end quote. End of misunderstanding. Chair Rosenbaum, please restore the ethical, honorable way of voting in Oregon, please. A mandate is current nonsense handicapping the true purpose of voting. Double majority is a balderdash approach of voting. Yes, I ask the state, or whatever it is, please assume my protocol in this level, to restore the people's faith or majority in our constitution activities. I thank you for listening and for attentive commitment on this very discordant issue. God bless the USA.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Are there any questions for these witnesses? Yes, Representative Hunt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you all three of you for being here. Appreciate your passion, and also really appreciate the League of Cities. When former Representative Pat Farr and I started working on this in 2003, we had to start calling around the county elections offices to try and come up with these one by one, measure by measure around the state, and it was a nightmare. I was so appreciative when, I think it was September of 2003, you all started to accumulate this data, and you've updated it several times since. Unfortunately, you've had new examples with every election. Just really appreciate the quality of that work. It's been really helpful, I think, for us who have been pursuing this issue.
Can I say one more thing quick tonight, please?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay. You know, how funny that the majority have this communion mind that we all think the same way in here, that we're talking exactly the same way, but so many different words that we have in the English language. Bottom line, we're saying the same thing. Majority is majority. They don't want to vote. They are forfeiting even the right for them to be counted. Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions? Representative Thatcher.
Thank you. This is Richmond. Don't leave yet.
No.
I guess you got to forgive me. I'm a little bit. At 77, I don't go by the rules.
No, you're okay. I just wanted to ask you a question. Maybe actually I have two questions for the whole panel, and you just seem like the appropriate panel to ask it to. I have heard proponents say, why would you plan an important election, such as the one you described, for an election that has a historically low turnout? That's
my one question.
And I'd be happy to answer that. And I guess as I do that, I will also refer you to, I think, page 30 in your book here, which has 35, which has some election results, which indicates that that is truly not the case, that the return is actually about consistent. But I can tell you from our standpoint in the city of West Lynn why we did it. And we have, of course, the levy, which is expiring June 30th. So we had a need to make sure that we get it out there and get it passed before June 30th so that we don't have to discontinue any services. And therefore, we did it on March. We automatically filed it for May as well, hoping that it would pass in March, but if not, knowing that we'd have to go back in May, which we are going to do.
Okay. Follow up to that question.
Yeah, follow up.
Maybe was there a city rule or reason that you wouldn't have put it on the November?
We had put it on the November ballot last November, and it failed.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And one of the things about the last November, we had actually had a higher rate because we had wanted to not only maintain but increase a bit, and it failed. So we reevaluated and stepped back and just had it so it was 75 cents per thousand. The original levy, we upped that, I think, to 84 cents for a cost of living increase.
Thank you. Thank you. My second question is, I have heard people say, well, it's my choice to participate by choosing not to vote.
I can answer that. As in front of a judge, that what he told me, that they're, like I said, it's their choice. All they have to do is by signing their envelope and returning it. They're not, in other words, they're not accepting it. But at least it counts. It is their duty, their responsibility to vote.
And I'll just follow up on that. We're looking at a neighborhood association revamping some of the rules for the neighborhood associations, and some of the neighborhood associations are not happy with that. So they intentionally chose and made this publicly known to not vote, to not participate. You have the paper article that talks about it that was in the Oregonian. Not as a means of opposing the levy so much as opposing what was being done for the neighborhood associations. So that was a clear instance where it was an intentional act not to vote because they knew the outcome of what would occur.
It clouded their mind.
So don't tell me that politics entered into this. Okay. Gotcha.
Yeah,
all right.
Yeah,
thank you.
Yeah. It's just, you know, when you're going to do something, I think you forfeit your rights.
Other questions? Okay. Yes, Vice Chair Berger.
Madam Chair, I have to comment to Mrs. Richmond that I wish there were a way to duplicate in this country your passion and involvement in our voting and democratic.
Thank you. But that's your country.
Yes, and I just wish we could duplicate your enthusiasm and get everyone to.
Thank you.
It's a necessity. It's not a necessity.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank
for your
you
testimony.
Very much.
Thank you.
Next, we'll call Tricia Smith, Gil Riedel, and Kepi Eaton. Morning.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tricia Smith. I represent Oregon School Employees Association, a public employee union representing 20,000 members throughout the state, working primarily in educational facilities. And I'm here in support of HJR 14. We have testified in other committees in support of a variety of repeals of the double majority, but I think HJR 14 is the one that should move because of the dates that it modifies. We believe that repealing the double majority for May and November elections is the right approach. It isn't a full repeal, but it is the elections that people know about for the most part. They expect elections in May and November, and the ballot comes to their house, they're not surprised. The other elections, fine, leave them the way they are, in our opinion. The only thing we would suggest changing with HJR 14 is the election date for the referral. We hope that you will put this election off to November 08 so that voters can take a look at this when they're in the mood to vote. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Go ahead.
Right. Madam Chair, for the record, Gil Riddell, Policy Manager, Association of Oregon Counties. Counties are in the teeth of a fiscal crisis caused by the expiration of the Federal Secure Rural Schools and Community Self-Determination Act of 2000, and it's $2 million a year in county revenues to Oregon. It's a joint challenge with the state because of counties and the state share service delivery responsibilities, as you've seen this ubiquitous chart. The crisis plays out differently by county depending upon the county situation, so it's highly complex. Any congressional action, I want to emphasize, merely gives us some breathing space to explore state and local solutions. Now, to HDR 14, 2 weeks ago, county commissioners and judges voted unanimously to request that the legislature remove the constitutionally structural handcuffs of the double majority and to establish a majority vote requirement for local levies for elections in May and November of any year. In other words, counties wholeheartedly support HJR 14. This by itself is not a cure, but it does give counties some tools to help themselves, and it does permit counties to better continue to contribute to the state county shared service system. So with that, Madam Chair, I'll conclude my remarks.
Thank you for your testimony. Good morning.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kathy Eaton. I'm the governance coordinator for the League of Women Voters of Oregon. And as you know, one of our main concerns is citizen participation, and our ability to make decisions has been greatly limited by the 50-50 or double majority. One piece of personal information, the idea that the majority makes the decision in democracies is held around the world. When I supervised elections in Bosnia in 2000, during the time of our 2000 election, I was in the middle of Bosnia in a city with 45 other supervisors, only six of us from the United States. The rest were from 20 other different countries. And when the first election results came out from the United States, and I came over to watch the television, and I said, well, who's been elected? And they said, we don't know. And I said, well, how is that? Well, they said, the person who got the most votes isn't being elected. Why is that? They said to me. It was a majority of votes, but the person wasn't elected, and I didn't try to explain to them about the Electoral College, etc. But the idea is that in a democracy, whoever gets the majority of votes, or the issue that gets the majority of votes, is the one that wins. And we're urging you to take back our citizen participation and voting rights by moving forward HJR 14. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. And so before I take questions, I wanted to remind our witnesses that when you answer a question, please re-identify yourself for the record so that we will have your name. Are there any questions for these witnesses? Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony. And next, we'll call Ron Naso, as well as Linda Brown and Krina Lemons. Please come forward. Good morning.
I'm chair, members of the committee. My name is Ron Naso. I'm superintendent of schools in the North Clackamas School District. And I am here in place of Joan Smith, our board chair, who usually comes down and speaks to the various committees about this particular bill. As I was sitting in the back of the room, Chuck Bennett from COSA whispered in my ear that he had to be at another meeting, so I'm also here as a representative for COSA. And Senator Devlin reminded me that I'm here in agreement with President Abraham Lincoln. So I am certainly humbled to be with you today. I'm here simply to ask for your support of House Joint Resolution 14. The North Clackamas School District, and I think school districts around the state, have had some significant history with the double majority, and in most cases that history has been negative. The North Clackamas School District actually has the honor of being the very first school district to fall under the rules of the double majority when it was passed those many years ago. We have a story similar to others that you've heard. We passed a bond issue, had the difference between the passage been filled in or backfilled by votes, we still would have won by a significant majority. Clearly, we have for years disagreed with the double majority in principle. However, it is a part of our Constitution, and we recognize that. We do know that changes have taken place in voting rules. Not only in voting rules, I might add, changes have taken place in voter lists. And a lot of that had to do with, again, the North Clackamas School District. We raised a rather significant set of questions with our Board of Elections back in 1998 about who was on voter lists. And I think that brought about some significant rethinking about how we keep those lists. But nonetheless, I would suggest to you one of the real arguments at the time was, gee, we don't want to be pulling people off of voter lists in order to make this double majority piece work. What we found during that whole series of investigations, we literally knocked on every door in our school district and checked our voter lists, found that people hadn't voted in years, didn't live there, a whole lot of pieces that subsequently have been fixed. The third piece of this, not only principle but the changing of rules, has to do with something very pragmatic, and that is the cost that this bill or that this particular law presents particularly to school districts. When you set, or when we in this state set, a two-year period between non-double majority elections, we are talking largely about school bonds. Now, I know a number of the other groups are talking about operating levies, and that's a different issue. But in school bonds, we're talking about needing to build buildings, buildings that are urgently needed for youngsters, and buildings that are subject to, in this day and age, escalating construction costs. A two-year delay means millions of dollars. So I would suggest to you that this is, in our minds, a reasonable and measured compromise to, I hope I don't take Mrs. Richmond too far out of context, but a reasonable and measured compromise to the balderdash that is the original part of the double majority. Thank you very much. We certainly urge the committee's support.
Thank you. Any questions for this witness? Okay. Please go ahead.
Good morning, Chairman Rosenbaum, members of the committee. My name is Linda Brown, and I have the honor to serve on the Lake Oswego School Board. Please, eliminate the undemocratic double majority law. This law is expensive. It encourages redundant and unnecessary elections, and it flies in the face of one of our most basic democratic principles: one person, one vote. The civic obligation to vote, to actually cast a ballot, is a participatory system which is critical in our democratic system. A small part of the citizen initiative passed as ballot measure 47 back in 1996. The double majority clause ironically creates an excuse not to vote by allowing non-voters a very powerful voice. As you've heard several times this morning, in Westland, a safety levy meant to put 12 police officers failed. Voters liked the measure. They wanted those officers. If every one of the 735 more ballots which needed to be cast had been a no vote, the levy would have passed. But thousands of yes votes were negated because the election was void. That's the double majority quirk at work. One a policeman, not on the streets. Since ballot measure 47 passed, more than 22 local
questions have failed due to this rule, and some of them were eventually successful. But multiple elections cost money, and they cost critically important volunteer time as well. In my Lake Oswego School District, we're very fortunate. We've succeeded in passing all of our local option and bond proposals. In the very first try, we've been lucky. Volunteers spent enormous amounts of time and energy on getting out the vote. They actually spent very little time on informing voters on how that money would be spent. People are willing to make a difference, but it diminishes the value that parents could provide. Volunteers would have been much more productive if they had been listening to children read and working on homework and math proposals, if they'd been tutoring and monitoring playgrounds instead. We knew that our community understood our needs well and would come through for us, but getting that mandated turnout percent cost everyone valuable time. Now, on the day of one of our elections, worried that we wouldn't get enough ballots turned in on time, I stopped by the post office and asked whether any ballots had been mailed too late to get into the election office. And I learned that many people mistakenly mail their ballots in on election day. But as soon as the mail is emptied from the mailboxes, it's trucked to the general sorting center where equipment is preset. And you know those yellow stripes on the envelope? Well, it spots those yellow stripes so that ballots can be pulled and put in a truck and taken immediately over to the election offices. So first-class mail is put on hold. But there's a problem. The end of day emptied in the mailbox is too late to get mail to the sorting office and actually over to the elections office by 8 o'clock. So the postmen live here, too. They offered me the opportunity to come back at 5 o'clock when they emptied the general mailboxes and dumpster dive and pull out those ballots, put them in a little shopping bag, which I did, I admit, and take them over to the library and stuff them in the ballot box so that they could be counted. Because it's the participation that matters, not whether they're yes or no votes. In 2000, a building bond for Portland Community College failed. 57% of voters said yes, but election participation was 49.9% of possible voters. Ironically, later investigation revealed that the voter registration rolls were inaccurate and included many people who had moved or who had died. If ballots could have been cast by 2,100 absent or dead people, all no votes, the bond would have passed. When placed on the ballot again in November, it passed with a 64% yes. But the point is, a whole year of building was lost. This is not a democratic principle that I can explain in any civics class. The double majority rule wastes money. By forcing schools and libraries and safety levies to either wait as long as 2 years to ask voters for needed financing or risk wasting money on expensive elections where a popular levy is defeated because of lower than mandated voter turnouts, the double majority law costs Oregonians in many ways. Money for building or repairing schools can't be levied when it's needed. While waiting for the double majority election opportunity to come around, inflation makes projects more expensive, and those are good jobs that Oregonians could use, going unfunded, and there are needs that are going unmet. Children sit in overcrowded classes while roofs leak, and local option proposals to lower class sizes have to wait until November of an even-numbered year, even though most local option levies run for 5 years, so the cycles aren't good. As the chairperson of the Oregon School Boards Association Legislative Policy Committee, I confirm that repealing Oregon's double majority law is a priority for all Oregon school districts. Across the state, this creates distinct and unnecessary hardship for volunteer school board members whose duty is to meet the educational needs of boys and girls. I urge your action on overturning this undemocratic and expensive and unnecessary law by supporting HDR 14. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions? Yes, Representative Thatcher.
Actually, I just have a comment. You brought up an issue that I think really needs to be fixed, too, and that's the fact that on Election Day, you know, the postmark doesn't count when you mail in your ballot. And I think that's something else that needs to be looked at. So there you go.
Chair Rosenbaum, if I may respond, in our neighboring state of Washington,
mailing in ballots on election day means they do count. People work here, people live there, people cross back and forth. So there's a lot of confusion, especially in the metro area. It's very common for people to think, well, I can put it in the mailbox. But actually getting it into the proper receptacle by the proper time, when people have had weeks to do so, again, is not the purpose of running the election. It's what's on the ballot that should count. Thank you.
Thank you. And let me again remind the witnesses to please identify yourselves. That was Linda Brown when you're answering questions. Okay, please go ahead with your testimony.
Good morning, and for the record, my name is Karina Lemons, and I reside in Salem, Oregon, Marion County. I am here today to concur with what you've heard already and urge you to eliminate the double majority rule. As a citizen, I take the privilege and responsibility of voting very, very seriously and spend many hours educating my children on their duty as well. It's absolutely devastating that the time and effort that goes into researching ballot measures, understanding candidates, and constitutional changes is canceled out, negated, and absolutely mocked by apathy. For those who don't show, I don't understand why they get the voice. I am also here today as the chairperson of the Salem-Keizer School District Board of Education. I, like you, am an elected official to uphold the laws of our land and to represent and reflect the values and culture of our constituencies. In my case, it's the citizens of two cities, Salem and Keizer, and two counties, Marion and Polk. I'm responsible for the academic success of 40,000 children who walk into our 72 buildings. But first and foremost, when they do that, I'm charged with their safety and their security first. The double majority rule directly impedes my ability to keep 40,000 children safe and secure every day. Salem-Keizer School District will within two short years be the largest school district in our state. We are growing by enrollment of over 800 students a year. That's a middle school a year. As you may have read in the Statesman Journal last week, Polk County is the fastest growing county, and Marion County is the seventh fastest growing county. A 22-member community task force, well-seasoned professionals in the construction industry, just completed a comprehensive 9-month study of the Salem-Keizer facilities. On the conservative side, with no enrollment growth exceeding what we've just talked about, we will need 10 more schools by the year 2010. That's in 3 years. Now, today, we're already packed to the gills. It takes strategic scheduling of lunches, PE classes, even passing times to make sure that our schools are not overcrowded to the point of violating fire occupancy code at any one given time. Salem-Keizer must build new schools, and that's going to take a bond measure to do it. A bond measure is necessary for me to continue securing the safety and security of 40,000 children every day. The double majority rule erodes my ability to plan, to seize opportunities against escalating construction costs. It erodes my ability to respond in a timely manner. We know that in the last 6 months, construction costs of materials and supplies have risen to in excess of 46%. The 6 months waiting for a November ballot means I've just cost 46% more of our taxpayer dollars. Also, as an elected official, like you, we are charged with working cooperatively and collaboratively with the other municipalities that are also charged with the safety and security of their constituents. We all must work with cities who need police stations, who need fire stations, who need libraries. We must work with higher ed institutions that are also busting at the seams and turning away students because there's no room in the inn. We used to work together to partner out or to budget, so to speak, our ballot measures and our request of voters, to spread out the need to make it palatable for everybody's wallets. With the sense of urgency, the double majority rule that has taken away our ability to budget out for our voters. We're forced to put our needs out there during the general elections all at once. Sticker shock rules, and it overrides all logic, and the only one who wins is apathy. And once again,
I'm unable to secure the safety and security of 40,000 children every day. When this measure was enacted, Oregon didn't have mail-in ballots. Today we do. Today there's no excuse for someone to take the opportunity to vote, to be educated about the issues. And I want to stop rewarding the no-shows. Ballot measures across the state, as Linda Brown have, and others before me have talked about, have also provided safe and secure facilities designed to ensure the best educational environments possible. They've won by those who voted and failed by those who didn't. We fail our children and we fail ourselves. We even fail the opportunities to feed our economic condition when we erode away at millions of dollars of construction jobs. I respectfully urge and appeal to you to support and move forward HJR 14, which remove the barriers, remove the obstacles, and help me keep 40,000 children safe and secure every day.
Thank you. Any questions? Okay, thank you both for your testimony. Is there anyone here who wishes to testify in opposition to HJR 14? Okay. Next we'll call Karen Cunningham, Jessica Adamson, and Ralph Corona.
But anyway,
to be democratic, go out there and complain about this bill.
Please go ahead.
Madam Chair, I'll do it quickly the way I did on Measure 27. I'm Ralph Groner with AFSCME. That's American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees. I'd only mentioned that I'm very proud that Clackamas County was well represented as far as legislators sponsoring this, but also the citizens who showed up here today. In behalf of our union, I'd like to say the question of fairness that, Bill Sizemore put this out. I actually debated him. Undemocratic, and it discourages those who do participate, and you've heard that in their voices. So I just like to add a new note. One person finally mentioned construction and jobs at the very end of all the testimony, and that's really my thesis. In the Tri-County with 1.5 million people, if you read the Oregonian, if you had the opportunity in their editorial yesterday, you'll see that Metro, ODOT, and the Oregon Business Association, as well as I'm sure AGC, have completed their study on construction needs with 1 million new people coming into that area. And the fact is we will lose over $1.5 billion in revenue if we don't get on top of construction needs. What's that have to do with HJR 14? In Clackamas County, where I had served for a number of years and have always been involved with road issues and transportation issues, I can tell you that we went out and we've tried to meet what Multnomah County has done for their highways with a separate levy and gas tax. Washington County has done the same. But in that tri-county, there's a flaw. Clackamas County has not been able to get a measure passed by the voters. And the result is Clackamas County, who by far has the most county highways of any of them. Frankly, you could combine the other counties. And we are threatened currently by industry saying we can't get our product to market. That's the idea in the whole article yesterday. And I can tell you that it's true. If we can't get our products to market and trucks have to wait, let alone citizens in their automobiles. By the way, the article wasn't just about Portland Metro. It's statewide. It was statewide congestion and our lack of dealing with it. Part of it is the fact that we have a double majority, and if we go out to an election, we lose on our highway improvement levies. That affects, my bottom line is, it affects congestion, affects jobs, and that cost us revenue that comes into this general fund to fund the schools, to fund all of our programs, and it may be the largest issue facing us, and that is the fact that you're taking a wonderful step forward when you go into work session to pass this. because it'll be one more tool that we can have to help get out and actually, when the voters support our measures for highway improvements, to improve our ability to attract business, to keep those trucks on the highway in a reasonable time, to get those products to market. So that's my concern. And those are my locals that testified today. And when we talk about a loss of members, those were in West Lynn, my members' jobs, and each and every one of them testified, by the way, were my members' jobs. Even if it's police and it's a separate union, they will take the money from the general fund in City of West Lynn, which is my local. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Please go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jessica Adamson here today on behalf of the Associated General Contractors. And we, like others, are in support of this legislation. And you've heard already about what it does in terms of construction costs. And we can tell you that we know the needs don't go away. The dollar just doesn't go as far. Ballot measures that fail, bond levies that fail, and you miss a construction season or two, or you wait for 2 years, you are facing tremendous costs, and those costs are often beyond our control. When international forces increase the price of steel, copper, cement, those are things that local contractors don't control, local governments can't control, but drive the cost of construction just tremendously high. We would also say that when you compress bond levies into a single election, like we saw in November, where you had $1 billion in capital bonds along with another $1 billion in really maintenance, and some of those are big maintenance projects where you're contracting those out, what you do is you can create a situation of glut of construction money. And when you have a whole bunch of money all at one time, you have a finite number of bidders. You're going to decrease the number of bidders per project, which is by its nature going to decrease competition and increase costs, just as a reality of the number of folks available to do the broad spectrum of work that comes in those time frames. So what it really ends up doing from our perspective, it decreases the ability of local governments to respond to needs when it's appropriate, but it also decreases for those voters, for all voters, it decreases the efficacy of the dollar that they're going to have to put in. So at the end of the day, it costs them more than if they were to pass these measures as they need to. So again, from the construction industry standpoint, This public policy is really about increasing the financial costs of the voters, and we don't believe that's a good policy to have. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Please go ahead.
Chair Rosenbaum and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Karen Cunningham. I'm vice chair of the Beaverton School Board. Perhaps even more relevant to this testimony, I chaired the Beaverton School District capital construction bond campaigns in May and November of 2006. I also served on the steering committee for the May and November capital construction bond campaigns that we ran in 2000. I'm here to speak in support of legislative efforts to amend the double majority turnout requirement. Thank you for this opportunity. You're probably aware that Beaverton's a rapidly growing school district. We gain approximately 700 new students each year. That's enough to fill a large elementary school. To accommodate this growth, our need for new facilities makes capital construction bonds a way of life. We typically propose a new bond to our community every 4 or 5 years. In May 2006, we put a $195 million bond on the ballot. This measure received 61% voter approval. It failed due to turnout requirements. We placed the same measure on the ballot in November, and it passed with the same 61% approval. The situation was quite similar in May of 2000, but turnout was actually higher, about 47%. And in that case, almost every one of the voters necessary to meet the turnout requirement could have voted no, and the measure would have passed. Again, we put it back on the ballot in November, and it passed. The current law exempts measures from the turnout requirement every other November. You might ask, as Representative Thatcher did, why we continue to try to pass our bond measures in May in spite of the double majority requirements. From our perspective, it's really an issue of how we run campaigns. Our campaigns rely on volunteers from our school communities to do the work that's necessary to educate our voters. While we can't campaign in our schools, we do organize our campaigns around school teams. Every building has a team consisting of parents and staff who recruit volunteers for phone banks, for canvassing, other campaign jobs, including standing on overpasses with signs, as others have mentioned. We also rely on school-based communication, newsletters, PTO meetings, local school committee meetings, to disseminate information. I'm sure all of you know that campaigns are time-consuming, expensive, and long-term projects. We can't get our campaign volunteers engaged in the summer in the school community. We can't form our school teams, allow them time to do their jobs, and to inform our community starting in September for a November election. So we feel it's necessary to attempt to pass our bonds in May in order to run effective campaigns. We do everything we can to get voters to turn out in May. We always hope that our bonds will pass in May, but we've clearly had difficulty doing that. Although the realities of running a campaign with school volunteers is a significant reason for placing our measures on the May ballot, there are others, most of which you've heard. If our 2006 bond measure had passed in May, we could have begun construction sooner. By waiting for the November election, we've lost an entire summer construction season. It's going to be difficult to get our first new elementary school from that bond open in September of 2008. We need to open new buildings in September. That's a reality of the way the schools work. So it is critical to time construction around that opening date. It's also true that the November ballots every other year become quite crowded with money measures, and that is a fact that caused us some concern last November. Fortunately, our measure did pass. Running two campaigns to pass our measures wastes community resources. I have personal knowledge of the hours and hours and hours of work every campaign takes, not to mention the loss of sleep over them. I also know what the financial resources that we needed to raise for those campaigns were. We are very fortunate in Beaverton that our supportive community gave us those resources twice in 1 year, both of their time and money. And I just think about all the good things those resources could have done in our community if we hadn't needed to run that November campaign. House Joint Resolution 14 would give us the flexibility to place our bond measures on ballots at two different times each year. It's really a reasonable compromise to the current law, and I urge you to approve it.
Any questions of these witnesses? Just a real brief one.
Yes, Representative Thatcher.
Karen, you mentioned that there was a $195 million bond measure. You had 61% approve. What was the turnout? And when was the election? I didn't catch
Please
that.
Please re-identify yourself before answering.
Chair Rosenbaum, Representative Thatcher, and Karen Cunningham from the Beaverton School Board. The turnout in May, I didn't bring the exact percentage. I believe it was about 41%. We had actually expected higher turnout, but other races on the ballot were not as exciting as they appeared to be in January.
Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony. We have two more witnesses. I'll call Lynn Lundquist and Carlin Levy. Good morning.
Good morning. Chair Rosenbaum, thank you very much for allowing me to testify this morning. I'm Lynn Lundquist, President of the Oregon Business Association. We believe that an important foundation of society is an effective government that is responsive to its people. That's why I'm here this morning. As Oregon Business Association, as you may have noticed, that we participate perhaps on a broader spectrum than you might anticipate from many business associations statewide. We actually have a government committee called Good Government Committee. And that sounds a little bit strange when you think of an education, business committee, environment, and so forth. We really believe that. And we believe this is a core foundation, and that's why I opened up by saying it is a foundation or society. And that's what this measure to me is all about. For example, on the Good Government Committee, we attack things like attack or work on things, judicial compensation, tax reform, campaign finance reform, and for one of the members of the committee, I'm sure very well connected, the fact that we work on the bottle bill. Those are the kind of issues. Those are all important to business, and that's why we are here to testify, is that we think the kind of government that functions best for its people, and that is a foundation for how we can have an effective business environment in which to operate. Earlier, Representative Hunt quoted Kevin Mannix. I'm going to not quite quote, but paraphrase what Steve Buckstein from the Cascade Policy Institute said on the other side of the building on this type of measure. And he was talking about the idea that, well, if you don't have the double majority, you could have even maybe 15% of the people support something that would still pass. Well, that's true. But and he made a point of the fact that even in the legislature, you have a majority of those that are the effective body, just like the citizens, 50% of them have to vote or you don't pass anything. Well, as I pointed out to him privately afterwards, probably a good number of you were not did not receive 50% of registered voter turnout. Not turnout, 50% of the registered voters. You did not receive that. The core foundation of our principle is simply that majority of the voters that turn out should be the ones that are recognized for whatever outcome they might have. I'd like to also mention a little bit, give you perspective in addition to what Senator Devlin did about 97, Measure 47 that brought this measure to, brought this aspect to us. I can tell you Sizemore was king. I was Speaker at the time, and I made the decision we were going to go along with what Mr. Sizemore wanted in the measure as far as this was concerned in the one we passed out as Measure 50, because we were concerned that we make sure that Measure 50 passed. So it wasn't the fact that we agreed with it. The fact of the matter was it was being pragmatic in what we could bring out of our body so that we made sure that 50 passed, because 47, as Senator Devlin indicated, was a mess to say the least. And we had to have that passed so it could be workable. I'll just finish by saying this. When we say the core of a foundation of a society is to recognize the voters, you might say, well, then why do you not just repeal the double majority? It makes a lot of sense. It's just a pragmatic, it's the realism versus utopia. And utopia in this is being to repeal it. The realism is, in fact, we think, and as you all agree, I think, have a better chance to pass this measure by doing the selection of the four elections in the biennium rather than all of them. To me, that makes very just good common sense. I appreciate the opportunity to be here, and this is a core foundation of our society.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee. For the record, I am Harlan Levy here representing the Oregon Association of Realtors. We support HJR 14 for all the reasons that you've already heard. I don't want to repeat previous testimony. We do believe the voters should be allowed to reconsider this issue, and we urge that you pass this bill out to the floor. I do have one comment about the bill, though, and I want you to take a look at it. I think this is something you might want to talk to the LC about. In line 5, where it says, notwithstanding subsection 8 of section 11 of this article, and then it goes on and repeats itself, subsection 8 of section 11 of this article does not apply. I'm curious why they drafted it that way. It appears to be a redundancy, and we know that when you have a constitutional provision, every word is going to be analyzed and parsed out. So that's something you might want to take up with LC before you move this bill to the floor. I don't mean to be the lawyer in the room, but I figured you want to know that.
It comes out in the mall.
With that, again, we do support HGR 14 and hope that you move this bill, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you. Any questions for these witnesses? Okay, thank you both for your testimony.
Thank
Is
you.
There anyone else who wishes to testify on House Joint Resolution 14? Yes, please come forward and identify yourself.
Quickly, Chair Rosenbaum, Lori Satinsville for the Oregon Community College Association. Just wanted to get on the record in support of HJR 14. You've had previous testimony in regards to Portland Community College and them having to run a bond measure again. I just wanted to say Rogue Community College in 2002 had the same issue. They had 46% of eligible voters turn out. They passed by a 6% majority and had to, again, use their resources to run the measure again and pass successfully. I just wanted to get up here and support of the measure. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony. Any questions? Okay. Well, I think that concludes our testimony on House Joint Resolution 14, and I will close the public hearing on HJR 14. Thank you, members. Seeing nothing further to come before us this morning, we are adjourned.